You're listening to Weird and Dead, the paleontology podcast that tells evolution's most embarrassing and bizarre stories. I'm Amy Atwater.
And I'm Megan Wetherell, and we're two living scientists who are weirdly excited about dead things. On this episode, we talk about dead animals entombed together, some of whom seem more excited to be there than the others.
From ominously falling ash to, excuse me, just let me just squeeze in there, and presumably fighting to the death, we talk about all the circumstances of how these couples came to be.
Also, a weird amount of time spent discussing the exact timing of rigor mortis.
Like always, our show talks about some disgusting things and sad dead animals, so please check the warnings in the description. Here we are together today to talk about fossil friends, like you and me. We're
church.
Fossil friends.
We are gathered here today.
We are gathered here today to continue to praise the devil. We're talking about fossil friends, and I don't mean me and Megan's amazing friendship.
No.
What we mean are animals or organisms that have been preserved together in the fossil record. And our big questions today are trying to discern, okay, were they doing that on purpose? Were they trying to hang out? Or was it preservation? Uh-huh. Is this an artifact of taphonomy? Like what happens between an organism being, you know, like dying and being discovered? Or were these organisms actually interacting? What's the nature of those interactions? And how the heck do we ever get preservation that allows for us to even ask these questions? Like what sorts of ingredients do you need to be able to preserve you and your best friend forever, for 100 yeah. million years? 100 million years. So arguably the most famous, they're not friends in this scenario. I'll just start with that.
It's frenemies. We're fossil frenemies. Sometimes they might
fossil
be friends.
Frenemies.
Sometimes they might be enemies. Sometimes they might be roommates. Sometimes they might be roommates with a winky emoji. You know, that's really the big question here. All of these could be interspecies love affairs. I don't know.
Except for the ones that are very clearly like mother and child. Let's just
is not not Game of Thrones level bullshit. No.
This is not an Oedipus rhino.
No.
Right. Yeah. You're right. You're right, though. Frenemies is important. We do a lot of the stuff we're talking about, at least what I'm talking about. I got stuck with all the dinosaur stuff this week. I mean, I embraced all the dinosaur stuff this week, and embracing is a good term. Okay, so I'm just cutting to it. The dueling dinosaurs,
yes.
Right? The dueling I've been hearing about these fucking fossils for over a decade now, over a decade now. I'm kind of a little over it, but I've been excited about the more recent developments in this, mostly because the people working on it now are very cool people. So the dueling dinosaurs is one of the best known cases of dinosaurs found together in the fossil record and have been very much interpreted as fighting. It is a juvenile T-Rex and a Triceratops that was found on private land in Montana in 2006. It only came to public attention in 2011 because they started such an impressive marketing campaign to sell it. It was very controversial then. It's very controversial now. I've actually had a role in this.
Ooh.
I kind of forgot about it. And then I was like, oh yeah, I had to go testify in front of the Montana legislature on this when I was working at Museum of the Rockies in Montana. So why? This specimen was found on private land, okay? And it's a very sexy specimen. And so they were like, well, we're going to sell it. We're not going to, you know, give it to a museum. We're going to sell it. Mm-hmm. They had a really hard time trying to sell it. And then eventually they got an offer, which is where it is now, with the North Carolina State University Museum.
Okay.
And then this is the tea. So when you are a landowner, and Megan, you are, I'm not. I don't know that. I don't count. I shouldn't be able to vote. You can own.
You're also
you can
a woman,
own your
so
land.
Really. Yeah.
When you own your land, you very rarely own your mineral rights.
Yes.
Mineral rights are subsurface rights to land that is way more confusing and patchwork quilt. Like, it is just chaotic. Mm-hmm. You, like, a one piece of land that's one individual family might own the surface rights to, there could be a dozen different players involved with those mineral rights. It is very complicated. And it exists because minerals, some of them, are worth a shit ton of money. It's all about economic value. So they're separated. And a lot of times this is like Shell, Texaco. All these groups are going to own your mineral rights and you don't own the surface. Or you will own the surface rights, but not the mineral rights. So when this fossil, it turns out, was going to be sold for a heck of a lot of money, the people who owned the mineral rights to that land came in and said, no, that's ours. We want that money because, yeah, we own the mineral rights. And fossils, by definition, are minerals. Therefore, they should be a part of this. I mean, it was a freaking, it was a shit show. It went to the Montana Supreme Court. I don't remember. I think I testified in like 2019. We were very on the side of no, they're not. For like a ton of reasons, mostly that like, A, therefore you're making all fossils be an economic mineral resource and they're not all. So now all of a sudden, if I just want to pick up some like ammonites that I find on my own land, now I don't own them because they're fossils. And so technically the whoever, it just gets really confusing. It also really threatens a bunch of fossil ownership claims in other places, in other parts of the state. Mm-hmm. So again, if we look at what has already been done, it was just very weird, especially because it's so fragmented and it can just be make access almost just like not possible. So eventually, I mean, and it's all because I spoke to the Montana legislature. Yeah, obviously. Yeah,
very
it's
convincing.
It's all because of me. Mm-hmm. It's like, hello. Fossils are not mined. We don't process them. We're not like putting them in, like, grinding them up. I mean, you can.
I guess. Yeah. And I mean, some of them have minerals, like there's the ones that are opalized, but that's a totally that's separate weird hybrid case. So
you can get pyrite's disease in a fossil, but pyrite is pretty worthless too. So
Fool's gold.
We just got to find that dinosaur with a diamond up its butt, and then that'll cause some controversy. That'll be all right. So eventually the Montana Supreme Court came down and was like, no, they're not mineral rights because of everything I just talked about. So that came down, which means they were able to finally sell the fossil to North Carolina State. It's with a paleontologist I admire a lot. Dr. Lindsay Zano is leading the charge on this. And one of the main preparators is a friend of mine, Nikki Simon, amazing human. So I know it's in good hands now. But the question has been, so did this juvenile T-Rex and this Triceratops, were they actually dueling? Were they actually fighting? Or did they just get washed in together? Now, the official stance by Zano is that, well, we haven't actually studied the specimen yet. It is still very actively being prepped. I'm pretty sure they have a live feed that you can go watch it be prepped in real time.
The slowest live feed.
Like, I hate prep work. So I find it just very... I find it very... Actually, go ahead and scroll to the first picture to see how it was, at least when Nat Geo got an image of it.
See, I vaguely, when I remember this story, I remember seeing pictures of some black bones and like just always some dude in a cowboy hat leaning over them.
I don't know if it was the
same guy or if it was just like classic white guy in a cowboy hat, like could have been a stock image. Like, that is the stock image from Montana, I think. But I remember the fossil being better prepped than this. So apparently I've blown it up in my mind. Interesting.
Yeah,
it's not well prepped. Especially to sell it
for what they were trying to sell it for is also really interesting. It's like buying something that you have to do years of work on. I guess that's like me trying to find a house right now.
See what is Tesla? It's in 16 pieces. You have to put it together.
Yeah. Oh, and no, we're not giving you a break in the price. Actually, we're trying to sell it for the most a fossil's ever been sold for before. We do not know. We don't know how much that they purchased it for. Okay. So that is kind of a secret. But they have kept it, Yeah. They, I mean, incredible work with the friends group that they had to bring together to raise enough funds. And as someone who is in development, I'm like, damn, that's impressive.
Yeah, who are those friends? I want those friends.
I want that money. Yeah, I definitely. Okay, so of course, the other reason that this specimen is very controversial is because it's a juvenile T-Rex. So, therefore, it is potentially going to be informative into the nano-Tyrannus debate that we've touched on before. But again, this is this idea that a very, very small but vocal group of dinosaur paleontologists have stated that there is a pygmy tyrannosaur present in the Hell Creek Formation and not just T-Rex.
Sorry, did you just say pygmy or pick-me?
That is how they describe nano-Tyrannus. Pygmy Tyrannus.
Okay,
come on.
Like small, is... not like pick me, not like I'm the best. I'm not like other Tyrannosaurus rexes.
Sorry, that's my, nope. I mean, it is that too. They think that and it's pygmy. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Because this is associated with, you know, like Bob Bakker and stuff. And so he loves a good miniature. Anyway, not very many people are on the Nano Tyrannus train. The folks that are very vocal, though, so you hear a lot about it. Those are the folks who've been a big proponent in marketing this and trying to sell it for a lot. So I just, anytime that there's money involved with the scientific opinion, I just, a big grain of salt, right? I don't know if what their intentions are. But that is one of the reasons that dinosaur paleontologists are excited about this specimen, is it's yet another sample size to go into this stupid debate about if there was another T-Rex out there or a smaller Tyrannosaur out there, or if what most folks think is that it is a juvenile T-Rex, right? Like we don't find just adults. So then some folks are like, well, it wasn't collected as a scientific specimen, so it is worthless. That's what Jack Horner said, which I find very funny coming from him, because I had to clean up his collections and office after him. And let me tell you about poor scientific quality. So I think that's a big, you know, and it is really interesting. Zano and her team are going back out to the original site to understand it in context of the geology to be able to answer that question better. So some really cool stuff is going to be coming from it. But honestly, you know, it's been very much marketed as they are fighting to the death, dinosaurs. And we really have no freaking clue about that yet. So we're still out on that.
Like, that is a lump of mud with, like, a dinosaur draped on top of it. And the only reason that I can believe that there's more than one is that there appears to be too many legs. But, like, it's just a bunch of legs coming out of a lump of mud. I feel like ascribing anything to this at this point is pretty, you're reading into it too much. So if it's not two dinosaurs fighting, what could it be? Amy, what is it?
What could it be? It could just be absolute happenstance. It could just be that they died near each other or they were both in the same debris flow. They were both in the same depositional environment. They were both in the same river. We've talked about this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the sturgeon too. It's like, was it purposefully up that hadrosaur's ass or did it just get shoved there by nature and the beauty that is nature? So great. The dueling dinosaurs is not helpful in terms of having a solid answer on if this is just how they were buried or if this is actually an interaction. So what are some other examples of true interactions, if there are any?
If you really want to know more about, like, whether or not these organisms interacted, I mean, there's going to be cases where you can never, ever prove one way or another. There is, however, there are cases where you can at least strongly suggest, because you, A, have a fully prepped specimen or a way to look inside of the specimen, like the example I'm going to talk about, and you have, like, forensic evidence, right? It's not like they wrote, like, love notes to one another if they were all hanging out. Like, you have to have some sort of evidence of interaction. Two animals being next to each other dead doesn't mean that they were, you know, biting one another.
Right.
So the example that I'm going to talk about next is significantly better studied. It is not controversial. It's just very, very cool. And it's
jealous.
Not dinosaurs, which is also a real big point in its favor.
That's one of the reasons why it's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. This one kind of blew up a little bit, I think like 2 years ago. It's a story of two different species of animals found preserved in the same burrow. So the two different animals are Thrinaxodon, which is a cynodont, which is like a fox-sized, not yet a mammal, kind of fucked up looking carnivorous maybe thing. Land dwelling, which is important, because the other animal it was found with is Brumastega, which is a temnospondyl, which is a kind of an amphibian, I think not officially an amphibian, but they look like a giant salamander sort of thing, right? That's what a temnospondyl is. And they concluded that, I did like this part of the paper, they concluded that Brumastega was in fact aquatic because, you know, I don't think that anybody knew that for sure, but they guessed. But they said that because there was too much cartilage, like there were too many spaces between its bones. And so it had to be an aquatic salamander.
Gravity would have just destroyed this poor creature.
Just flippity flopping around on land. So this burrow, it comes to us from the Karoo Formation of Africa, and it is part of the Triassic. So right after the Permo-Triassic extinction, which, you know, huge carbon dioxide, very, very hot. That said, the Triassic, still generally regarded as a super shitty time to be alive, just really, really hot. Probably you had to be good at A, dealing with lots of heat, and B, dealing with long periods of time where that heat kills off all of your food. So there's a lot of expectation that a lot of these different animals were probably pretty good at things like either burrowing or stealing other animals' burrows. And if you look at the Karoo Formation, there's a lot of burrows. Like there's tons and tons of burrows in this particular fossil formation. Some have animals in them, some do not. Thrinaxodon is known from a couple of other Triassic sites and at least one Triassic burrow where they found it curled up just in its burrow as if it was asleep before it died. Cute,
interesting.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At rest.
At rest. So it's not clear necessarily whether Thrinaxodon was capable of long periods of hibernation. I guess they have done some studies where they've looked at the bones of Thrinaxodon and they don't find basically like tree ring like structures that indicate that they were dormant for long periods of time. But we've talked about this before on the show. A lot of mammals are capable of doing torpor, where they're down for a couple hours, they're down for a couple days, they're resting, they're not wasting a lot of energy, which is the whole point of hibernation or estivation, which is what you usually call it when it's in the summer, which is probably more likely what you would have had here because it was hot as hell. So Thrinaxodon, we know they've been found in burrows. Not clear if they were making them, but they were at least in them. Brumastega, not so much, right? So we have these two animals. They're pretty similar in size. So they're about fox-sized for both of them. Brumastega is slightly longer. And they are inside a very small burrow. The size of the burrow is kind of important because that suggests that the Brumastega was not shoved into it with the force of water, right?
Okay.
Had to be an intentional entrance on the behalf of the Brumastega. Can't just be like what potentially the dueling dinosaurs are. There's more evidence to it. You guys can't see that Amy is tilting her head kind of thinking about that. But
is it easier for like water to shove you in a hole when you're already a weird amphibian who's not supposed to be burrowing? Or is it harder for yourself to squish your worthless body into a hole?
How slippery was it? Are we talking like hagfish level goo?
Was this hole well looped? These are...
Well, the thought is no, in part because Thrinaxodon is terrestrial. So that said, they were buried in what are flood deposits. So if you look at the sediment of this burrow, you can see the bottom of it has what they just described as basically like loose, shitty sediment that they think the animals were just kind of walking around on and scrabbling around on. And then you have some thick sandstone deposits that cover most of the body that they think was just like a big flood rush. And then you have some slight layers of sandstone and it fines upwards. So basically you have like a slowing down of a flood event. So whether or not it was shoved in that way is you know, I believe that they probably didn't for some of the reasons that I'm going to talk about in a second. But
okay,
it at least was covered up by a flood. And then they were entombed together. And the only reason that they were found is these scientists pulled out this burrow. They noticed that there were some bones sticking out of it. And instead of just going through and like chipping away and cleaning it, they also didn't want to do that. So they used synchrotron imaging, which...
Oh.
Yeah. So what do you know about synchrotron imaging? Because I know very little.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to deal with this a little bit at Museum of the Rockies, too. We did not have a synchrotron, but there was a PhD student at MSU at the time working with a dinosaur paleontologist there. And he was looking at, this PhD student was looking at troodon eggs. I'm sure he's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure he's like published on this. This is common knowledge. I don't know why I'm pausing. He was just looking at troodon eggs and trying to figure out if there's embryos inside. And so he got permission to
breaking
take
them open.
This.
That's
like a certain other person known from there. Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Right. So he was able to take it to the Berkeley Synchrotron, which I have heard is like this giant room that literally has this very circular kind of system that's spray, you know, doing all of the intense imagery, intense lasers and danger things. I don't know. But I do know that it leads to even more precise. Like with a micro CT, you can get like down to the point some millimeters. And I think with synchrotron, you can get even greater detail than that.
Mm-hmm.
However, what I heard from him was the hardest part is then you have the data and you have to process the data to actually generate your images. And that is the part that from what I heard from him, at least, was insane. And he was actually building an AI system to do it for him. Kind of probably like what you were doing with your PhD, morphometric stuff, because it was too long for him as an individual to process all that data in that time frame. So that's what I know about a synchrotron.
Yeah. So they ran it through a synchrotron and they did find that they didn't quite describe it. I think it's different bone. Like the bone is a different density than the rock. And so that's why you can see it popping out. But there's some difference. And I think they had to do some hand carving of the data. And then I think they had some algorithm that was pulling out a lot of the rest of it. But they found, oops, too much bone. It can't just be Thrinaxodon. And sure enough, there was also Brumastega. So it's like just like an accompaniment to a fossil that they already had seen and had been expecting, which I think is kind of cool, right? Like,
I think it's
cool. Extra bonus.
My immediate question, though, is the synchrotron shit, as far as I know, is advanced and expensive. So is Thrinaxodon so special and like unknown that it's... I'm just curious about the steps that they took that led to using a synchrotron, I guess. Like, are these, you know, is this... That's my reaction.
They just said that they found it kind of incidentally. So I'm not sure why they decided to do it. I mean, it seems more convenient to do that than to prepare it out if you're not also the person who then has to like carve out each slice of your enormous data file. I'm sure they made a student do it. That's how a lot of these labs go, right? Yeah, so you get some different densities. You can segment them out. And so what they found are these beautiful, beautiful images of these two specimens. The Thrinaxodon, which again, it looks very dog-like, is kind of curled up a little bit. It's kind of got its arms underneath it, but it's got its head turned at a real weird, somewhat unnatural angle. It's also got some broken ribs. Its ribs are broken on the left-hand side, which I think is where it's shoved up against the burrow. When you look at the broken parts of the neck and you look at the broken parts of the rib, they are kind of these really like sheer fractures. They're basically the sort of thing that you get post-mortem. Like this wasn't something that it wasn't like slammed up by Brumastega, who just really wanted to get into that burrow. It seems as though...
A body slam.
Yeah, it probably wasn't a body slam. It probably was... Well, it was a body slam, but it was a you're in already a body, you're probably already dead sort of slam. Brumastega, on the other hand, Brumastega isn't... So Thrinaxodon is laying on its belly. It's very cute, other than the whole broken neck and broken ribs thing. And Brumastega is laying upside down. So it's got its tummy facing upwards. It's like half, it's honestly like if you sleep with a toddler, I think it's kind of similar, right? Where like Brumastega is upside down and on top of Thranaxodon and has shoved Thranaxodon kind of off into the side. It's shocking that there's not like a leg in Thranaxodon's face. That would be the full toddler sleeping experience. But
so true.
Right? So Brumastega is upside down. Brumastega also has broken ribs. But those ribs show signs of green bone fractures. It looks like they were broken while Brumastega was alive. Also, some of them are healed. So some of them show signs of like coming back together and healing. Some of them even show their partial fractures as if it was pushing up against tissue, right? Because, you know, you don't just have air beneath your ribs. You have meat and gross stuff. So yeah, just gunk. So the idea is that Brumastega probably got battered ribs before coming into the burrow long enough ago that it was probably still healing from them, but it wasn't necessarily what killed it. There are also two puncture marks on Brumastega's like eye socket, or two holes. They don't go all the way through, and the paleontologist mentioned that, like, you know, synchrotron is great. They didn't get quite good enough resolution to determine if they are tooth marks or if they are like dissolution pits or if they are like some sort of infestation. So there are some dots. They're not the right size to be the Thranaxodon's teeth. They are too big and they're too far apart, but it does have some mysterious holes on its head. So Brumastega healing from an injury, Thranaxodon curled up as if it's sleeping inside a burrow that is presumably Thranaxodon's and not Brumastega's. The thought is that Thranaxodon was already in there. Brumastega joins the chat, I guess, and comes on inside the burrow. And so the question is, was Brumastega dragged in by Thranaxodon? Was it shoved in by water? Or did it come in voluntarily? And was Thranaxodon still alive when it came in? Right, because you could have had Thranaxodon die.
That's true.
Beforehand.
Right. Just be hanging out in the crypt. Yeah.
Right?
For sure. Peaceful.
So
quiet.
They don't think probably that it was dragged in because A, it's a pretty tight squeeze. I'm not sure how Thranaxodon would have dragged it in and then turned itself around. But also the holes on the head don't really seem to match it. So it doesn't seem likely that Thranaxodon was dragging Brumastega in. So you can probably get rid of that one. The thing that they brought up in the paper is, you know, if you die in a burrow, your body's typically mummify, right? You dry out and desiccate, which makes you stiff. So if you are dead in a burrow, you dry out, you get stiff. If water or Brumastega or whatever comes in, it might shove you up against the wall, but it might also shove you up against the wall in a way that is crackly, like shoving jerky against a wall, not a steak. Yes?
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, right. For those poor, vulnerable little braille ribs in there.
Yes. So you could be mummified. You would also have something like that if the animal had recently died and was going through rigor mortis. But if they had gotten through the rigor mortis phase, they'd be limp again. So there's like two stages of limpness. There's you're alive or very recently dead. Then you get stiff for rigor mortis. Then you soften up again.
Yep.
And then you mummify, right? So when you look at both Brumastega and Thranaxodon, both of them look soft because their tails are kind of both like, they look like they're spooning basically. And they're like curled up towards the entrance of the burrow. So it looks like they were like still floppy. So either both of them died at the exact right moment so that they were, neither of them were rigor mortis-y. Or they were both alive at the same time, which the authors kind of argue is probably the more realistic version, because otherwise it's a very small timeline to have those two animals coexist. So what they think happened is that Thranaxodon was curled up in his burrow. Brumastega, probably because it was still healing from an injury. This is also a juvenile, by the way. So this is some dumb teenager.
Okay.
Crawls into the burrow. Just shoving its way in there. And then the Thranaxodon either was, they think it just didn't bother kicking it
out. Or it just happened that the next second was the sedimentation that buries them.
Yeah.
It's yeah. Like, hello, I brought a flood.
There's something behind me. Can I just scooch in here? Excuse me. And then they think that once the flood came in, that's what knocked Brumastega over. So they did bring up that this isn't entirely unknown, that even though you would think that like an animal who digs a burrow isn't going to be super stoked if other animals come into the burrow, sometimes when you're hibernating or you're in torpor, you are too tired to give a shit.
Yeah.
And the example that they gave is there are some badgers in Poland that have been known to just let it lie if their burrows get invaded by raccoon dogs, which is an animal that I didn't know existed.
Yeah, me neither. So, yeah. I should know that. I've literally studied dogs.
Whoops. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like from the name, I have a pretty solid idea of what it looks like and what it is. So that's the thought on Brumastega anthracnidon. There's still other potential scenarios. You know, it could be pretty closely after rigor mortis, so a couple days post-death. But yeah, they think that the most realistic one, and I agree, is that Thrinaxodon was just like, I'm napping, and then they died together.
Oh, that's it's kind of peaceful. Yeah, I mean, why not? Sure. And I could also understand if like maybe whatever event was happening that displaced Brumastega from its watery place and like encouraged it to seek out this shelter is the event that then buried them, or I don't know, you know, like that's where I get into a lot of it. It's just like, how were you preserved like that? Like, how was that moment? So often I go on the side of, no, I think it was just random because it seems so hard for in this, you know, fossilization so rare already to also preserve an actual interaction is fascinating. It's fascinating. Yeah. With a cozy little, you know, salamander friend to just get through.
Flipping over.
Yeah. I mean, that's relatable too.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's an example of two organisms that, we think at least there was pretty close to like either both of them are alive or like it was just the world's most coincidenty of coincidences, but a little bit more evidence than for the dueling dinosaurs. A little bit less dramatic of a story too, because it's not they were fighting, it's fuck it, fine, you can stay, which feels a little bit more realistic as well. I mean, really, when you think about it, when are you most likely to be fossilized? When you are fighting an animal to stay alive?
Right.
Yeah. Or when you are napping.
Or when you are swimming next to an active volcano. Just saying. Just saying. In my life.
That's fair.
Probably the next time I like go to a tar pit and I'm just like, let's do it. Woo! Jump right in. For animals, though, especially something that's going to be burrowing. Right. Uh-huh. You're already... And I was talking to a coworker, to Katie, our editor, today, who's telling me about prairie dogs and how they build the tunnels here. And then some type of owl uses their burrows. And it's this symbiotic.
Burrowing owls.
And I'm like, if you're called a burrowing owl, then fucking burrow. Like, you don't let someone else do it and then take that title. But they didn't name themselves.
What are you talking about? I thought that you love a lazy queen.
I'm just jealous. Just jealous always that I don't think of this. So we've talked about a probably not actually associated, but just died together or like were preserved together. Now we're talking about one where it's like, well, okay, they probably had maybe a very minor interaction and did know that they were on some level in each other's space. And now I'm going to tell you about one that is, no, they were fucking fighting.
There's
no question about it, but I heard all about it. Folks probably have heard about it too. It's this incredible fossil from China that features a mammal like full blown fighting with a Psittacosaurus, which is a dinosaur kind of related to Triceratops. It's a ceratopsian, and there is legit interaction in this fossil, and it is it's very fascinating. So yes, let's see. This is from the Lower Cretaceous of China. This is Repenomammus robustus, which is a type of, I looked at Gobi conodontid mammal, which is a non non-therian mammal, kind of like what I think you're talking about with Pteranaxodon. So these are, you know, these are mammals that were, yours are much older, but this one is mm-hmm. the one that was around from like 180 to like, I don't know, 90 million years ago or so.
Okay.
And it was thought to be carnivorous. And again, non-therian is, so the therian mammals today are us, like placental mammals and marsupials, but not monotremes, the platypus and echidnas. They're also technically so non-therian.
No nipples. That's the cutoff there.
Probably.
This is a nippleless mammal. Try to wrap your head around that, guys. It probably excreted milk just like a platypus.
This is so true. Now I'm like scrolling through the page to be like, nipples. Tell me about their nipples.
Where are the nipples? The nipples, I imagine, were not fossilized. Well, they couldn't have been. It didn't have them.
And I think it also means that these mammals were laying eggs. That's a pretty big indicator, too, is that the...
I feel like the nipples is defining. More important, but...
Hours of entertainment with the nipples.
That's what she said. Yeah.
So many good times. So we've got this little nippleless mammal, Rapenomammus, which is funny because mammus means mammal and nipples, but you know, the Rapenomammus is thought to be possum sized, which when I read that, I keep seeing that places. And I'm like, there's a lot of fucking possums out there, guys. It's actually not that helpful. But I think generally like the Virginia possum that we see here in the United States. So we're talking like maybe a big cat sized animal. Yeah. And then Psittacosaurus is a relatively small dinosaur, honestly. Psittacosaurus is very well known from China and Mongolia, famously for its preserved cloaca, which we need to do a full deep dive on that cloak. Legitimately. So they were found together. Oh, the other thing I love about Psittacosaurus is I know because there's so fucking many of them and they've been preserved in such great detail. They really do know that they had like this mohawk kind of thing on just its tail. Like it's not on the neck or the back. It's like the tail has just got this like crazy spines and whatnot that come off of it that make it have a really special kind of David Bowie flair that I appreciate. Yeah. And like a full blown beak. I mean, it's just a weird looking animal and then found in this, what they call Mortal Kombat. So scroll past the one fighting dinos, whatever. You didn't see that. And you can see this specimen here, and the first picture shows you the actual specimen, kind of a bird's eye view with a reconstruction of what they would have looked like in life, and then we'll get to that next one. So what's really interesting is that there is one of the legs of the mammal is trapped underneath the Psittacosaurus, and his teeth are in like its rib cage, like in its belly. Okay. If we scroll down, you can see another picture that shows you from the paper exactly what I mean by interacting. There are it is like in there. It's got one of its hands, so one that of its four like limbs.
Badger behavior, like, just fucking digging in. Nothing is going to stop this animal.
Yeah, it's trying to burrow into the Psittacosaurus.
Yeah.
FYI, the back door is the easier entry. I would go that way, my friend.
I can't wait.
I don't know what you're doing trying
to
get through the fucking rib cage. Good luck. So, like, literally, so one of the hands is in the jaw, the lower jaw of the Psittacosaurus. Oh, wow. Like it's grabbing its mouth and pulling its jaw down, which my son does do to me sometimes, and he has like baby strength. It's
fish
really
hooking.
Intense.
It's fish hooking the Psittacosaurus.
Yes. Yeah, it's noodling.
With its entire body. Yeah. I mean, it's got most of its body just in there. Yeah.
It failed. It failed horribly. And so then the other, like it's got a leg that is embedded in the lower hind limb that's wrapped around like the tib fib. And then the teeth and the mouth are literally still embedded into I think it's they talk about it being like the chest or the kind of belly rib cage area of the set. So, I mean, this is like full blown everything that's very, very much connected. Now, what's really interesting about this is that, well, there's a lot of really interesting stuff about this. It was discovered also probably by private, you know, folks mm-hmm. who we don't understand the precise locality information. We don't know okay. exactly the provenance for this. That seems to be, that actually was part of the problem with dueling dinosaurs too, which yeah. is interesting that we see this in these frenemy situations, is that a lot of times they're discovered by private folks. And then we do lose a little bit of scientific information because of that sometimes, if it wasn't taken in context. It also leads to the concern that it is fake, that it's fraud
yeah.
and has been a faked specimen. However, I can't find anything that shows that. It looks like this has been thoroughly researched. There are ways to know if bone has been faked or not. Mm-hmm. UV light, x-rays, CT scans. There are ways to know if this is faked or not. And so far from what I'm reading and what I've heard from the community is no, this seems to be very, very much legit. And again, it's one of these situations where it's debated. So were they actually interacting, or were they just discovered like this with this one?
I feel like they were interacting, and I feel like I know the vibe as well of that interaction, and it wasn't positive or friendly. And just right. to kind of go off that point of fakes, it's not just that, like, could they have made fake bones and put them in place? Like, literally the glue that they would have used glows mm-hmm. under UV light. Mm-hmm. Like, there's, and you could do chemical tests on that stuff as well. So if there's not been a paper saying it's a fake, I would assume it's not a fake, even though it looks fake as hell.
It looks fucking fake. Yeah, it really does. It's just like a level of preservation that is very unheard of. However, yeah. it's very known for this site. So this is a Cretaceous site in China. Let me pull up my...
Or where we think the site is, I guess, right?
Well, we do know generally because okay. of, again, just the matrix and everything. They do know actually the exact unit of okay. a formation, the Jehol group.
Oh,
of,
okay.
Yeah, this is one of the Jehol group fossils. So these are some of the most best preserved fossils that we know in the world.
Yeah.
What's really interesting is that some of the majority of the Jehol fossils are these two-dimensional compression fossils, right? Like, we've talked about that
yeah.
too. A lot of times you get buried and smashed. The reason the sturgeon was so beautifully well preserved is that Hadrosaur's butthole protected it from getting smashed in between layers of rock and losing yeah. all of that delicate detail of the dookies. So that's where this is interesting too, is some of the fossils from the site are just very smashed, and then some are these incredible 3D situation, which isn't always easy to interpret then how they formed. I'll just say that right now it looks the consensus from the authors is that the animals were buried right where they died, and that they really do think that they either happened simultaneously or very very close. So I am trying to understand if they think it was, I don't think they were already, they thought they were already dead, but it is possible that the mammal was scavenging the carcass of the dinosaur when they became buried, because we don't really see the Cetacosaurus doing anything back. It's kind of Brumostega-ing this. It's like, take yeah. me, I deserve it. I'm not worthy.
It's taking a very passive role in being eaten.
Yes. And then there was, like, they went into this whole part where they did this phylogenetic least squares regression, where they were looking at, like, is it plausible that a small mammal like this would be feeding on such a big Cetacosaurus, because we do know that Repenomamus eats Cetacosaurus. Mm-hmm. We have found little baby Cetacosaurus bones in other Repenomamus specimens. Mm-hmm. So another interaction that's proven, because it's in the fucking guts of another one. That's a pretty slam dunk on that. But to go after something that was so much larger than itself is questioned. But then they compare it to a lot of what we've been talking about, yeah. modern day mammals, a lot of them being mustelids, you know, our weasels, yeah. badgers, wolverines, that are like, fuck yeah, I'm going to take down a caribou, you know. I mean, these are it's very plausible
yeah.
that this mammal was fighting with or feeding on this specimen, but there aren't other, like, there are no other tooth marks on the specimen either. So they didn't think that it had been left out for scavenging all that long, because it seems like it would have had a lot more marks by that too.
Okay.
So they don't think They don't seem to think that it was scavenging. They instead think that they were buried. Their hypothesis is that they were buried while the predation was going on and that they were entombed by this very sudden lahar-type volcanic debris flow. So a volcanic situation in there too, that it actually would explain why they're so entwined, that the left hind foot of the mammal became trapped underneath that left leg of the dinosaur when it collapsed because of this kind of lahar. And they say that that's what would account for no more other tooth marks or indications of scavenging. I guess my point, and we'll get into this more, is, okay, so it's a lahar, so it's clutching on, like, save me from the lahar, daddy? Or is this, like...
rafting?
Right, is it rafting this dead Psittacosaurus through this motherfucking debris flow? Again, how did it, like, if, okay, so the lahar is what got the one leg trapped underneath the Psittacosaurus. Is the lahar what got its hand grasping its face and its other hand grasping its tip fib? Like, I just have these, and I just go to, like, but how with a lahar, which I think of as a fairly high energy situation, is allowing for these to be preserved so exquisitely? I am so completely and so in articulation. So... those are, I'm excited to chat here when we dive into more on how the heck does this happen? How do they preserve?
Just to give some more context for those of you who are not looking at this photo, and also if you're not aware, we do put these photos on our websites. We do forget sometimes, but we do eventually put them on there. So the photos that we talk about for all the episodes are on weirdanddead.com. But it's kind of like I realize that this is not the actual size of the animals, but like... scaling, it looks like a Jack Russell going after a Great Dane. Okay. And the Jack Russell has like curved its body so badly that it is both biting the animal and looking at its own ass. So while its hands are like akimbo, like spread eagled, holding on to different things, which looks uncomfortable. And weasels are psychotic. So like, I know that some predatory mammals are just weird and they do weird things when they're attacking. I guess if your body is that long, maybe looking at your butt is like a pretty regular occurrence, but it does look like maybe it got moved a little bit. That's kind of what I'm thinking. And then just clung on like an asshole while that was happening. But the Psittacosaurus has its legs curled underneath it. And it looks like it just kind of gave up, but it doesn't look sorted or anything. It doesn't look like it's streamlined or was moved very far with the lahar, which is very interesting.
And it couldn't have been, because there's no way that it would have been able to be this pristine of just preservation, articulation, 3D, you know, like it's just, that's where, I guess it's me going the transport and the burial here. I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around, you know, I have a geology degree and I'm just like, that's not what I remember about lahars. I just don't remember them being like, I'm a peaceful little like, oh, I'm going to hug you with some hot volcanic shit. Okay, so I just, you know, I maybe it's a blessing to not know more about lahars. I will say this. The only part of the paper that I highlighted, I highlighted a few, is one of their conclusions is, the new fossil thus challenges the common assumption that Mesozoic mammals were merely fodder for the ruling dinosaurs. I'm like, who's common? This is not how I think. Sure, okay. Of course there are mammals eating dinosaurs. Like, of fucking course. Like, there's so many different dinosaurs, too. Like, some of them were delicious.
Some of them were small, you know?
Yeah, some were small. And they all had small babies, so yum.
Yeah. So the thing that is weird when you're talking about like ash preserving living animals is A, sometimes they see it coming, so they are trying to escape. And B, like it's very rarely gonna just gently settle on them, right? Like it's gonna have some form of movement. But that's not always the case. So a really great example of a lot of animals preserved together in some clear interactions would be Ash Fall fossil beds in Nebraska, which is a beautiful, beautiful fossil site. It's from the Miocene. I think it's like 11 or 12 million years old. And there are tons of animals, but they have like this really weird stratigraphy. So At the bottom of the site, they have kind of a sandy layer, and they find things like salamanders and lizards. They find lizards inside of crane bellies, like Crane the bird. Ooh, wow. Yeah. So you find a lot of small animals. Crane the bird. You could be thinking of a mechanical equipment.
Yes, in the Miocene, yes.
Yes, all of those. So you find all of these kind of small animals at the bottom of this like sandy layer. And then you go up and you find this big, thick ash deposit. And inside the ash deposit, you find rhinos. Just like, I think over 100 rhino fossils have been found of Teleosteris, one particular species. You do also find camels and horses, but they're not as commonly talked about because there's also this giant fucking rhino herd. They are all so beautifully preserved that you can see things like, we now could confirm that the like some of the differences in their teeth were male versus female, because you could see a fetus inside the female. Yeah. So wow. you could do all of these insane wow. studies. But the ash that they're in is like soft ash that fell from the sky. And unlike this Tsicatosaurus, they're on their sides as if they've slumped over for the most part. There's at least 3 cow-calf pairs. So 3 mama rhinos with their baby rhinos, including at least one that's in like a nursing position as if it was nursing while it died.
Wow.
But like they're on their side dead before the ash is covering them, which is kind of more what you expect with this sort of thing, right? Like if you're getting like a soft rain out of ash, it's not usually, yeah, you could run the fuck away, or you would have to be dead for it to cover you, or right. you would have to do what happened to these animals, which is suffer for weeks at a time. Because the other thing that we see with these rhinos and with the camels and with the horses, one of the horse has a foal right next to it as well, is you see massive chunks of frothy, kind of bubbly looking bone on all of these animals. Yeah, delicious. Just take your latte and then imagine that that's bone. And it's growing on the distal, so the portions of their limbs that are furthest away from their heart. So especially prominent in like the ankles, the wrists, but just like the far end of the bones is where you get this accumulation of like nasty, frothy bone. I did read a study that had taken some isotopes from the frothy bone compared to the regular bone and had cross-compared them and found that maybe there was evidence that they had a fever, basically, when they were depositing that bone. And so that frothy bone is a really weird side effect of lung trauma. And it turns out that this happens to modern animals too and modern people. It's called hypertrophic osteopathy or osteopathy, however you want to emphasize that, or Marie's disease. And if you get real fucked up lung or cardiac problems, sometimes they think that your platelets don't get like pulled out by your lungs. So your lungs have like lots and lots of little capillary beds. So if you have a big old chunk of platelets floating through, it'll kind of pull it out and then it can deal with it. If you have so many problems that your heart is basically shunting blood past the lungs, which can happen sometimes, then your platelets don't get taken out. They get stuck in the capillaries of your fingers and toes. And platelets are associated with a hormone that could potentially be causing all of these problems. So we've seen this sort of thing in like modern animals that have lung cancer, tuberculosis, pneumonia. All of those things, you can get this kind of frothy bone growth. So did this entire herd of rhinos have pneumonia? Probably not. We think that it was severe trauma from inhaling ash for weeks. That basically, maybe they didn't die right away. In fact, we know they didn't die right away because it takes a while for the bone to get that nasty.
Right. Of course, it's going to take time before it's not an instant thing.
Yeah. So you get... these animals are inhaling all of this ash. It's causing all of this trauma to the lungs. It's causing all of these kind of downstream problems. Their bones are growing deformities. And then finally, they can't do it anymore. And so they're at a watering hole and they all die together. So that's the more classic style very Jim of ash.
Josh. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I don't know who that is, but I believe you.
Drink the Kool-Aid, the giant, the biggest mass suicide, and
this is a cult thing. Leader? Yeah, I know this you like that stuff, but there's no dragons in it, so why would I
Be they are there are dragons. They're oh. just men.
Oh, yeah. That's I don't like metaphorical ones.
Thank you for listening. If you liked the podcast, be sure to rate and review us on your listening platform of choice. We really appreciate it.
If you'd like to hear more and support the show, follow us on Patreon for some exclusive bits or on our various social media platforms. You can follow Amy on Instagram at Mary Anning's Revenge.
And Megan on Instagram and TikTok at Geopedal Fabric, or both of us at Weird and Dead on Instagram and TikTok. This podcast is part of the Geology Podcasting Network.
Produced by the traveling geologist, Chris Spencer.
Cover art provided by Chris Spencer and the hosts.
Our theme song is Unlock Me by Praz Kunal. Editing services provided by the amazing Katie Bradley.
Hosted by and researched by us, Amy Atwater and Megan Weatherall. Thanks for listening. Rigamorous, girl!